Thank you for downloading this podcast from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. To download digital content, please visit elmod.pardes.org. Join us in Jerusalem this coming January 5th to 9th for our winter learning intensive titled The Many Faces of Me, Exploring Identity in a Postmodern World. We'll tackle tough identity questions through Jewish learning, conversation, and community building. For more information, visit pardes.org.il/WLI.
Boker Tov Lekulam. Good morning, everyone. I was going to say Brochim Abaim, but also welcome. So what Abby and I thought we would do, but I had to make a quick switch because she had a problem with the transportation. But we'll still keep the format into three parts. Just I'll speak more for my part of the three sections, and then she'll join me as soon as she can. So what I'd like, first of all, thank you for coming. Thank you for attending. There's a great speaker speaking in room C. I wish I could go hear her right now myself. So thank you very much for taking time out of your day and making the choice to be here. So we're dividing this talk up into three parts of our lives. The first part is where we come from, what we were born into, what was our childhood like, our very beginnings of coming into being. And then we thought we would share, after a few questions, we thought we would take a break after that to allow some questions. Hopefully we'll have some answers. And then we wanted to move into what led up to our gender transition and what was that experience like for us. And again, after that, allowing for some Q&A. And then, how do we live our lives now? Now that we're both on the other side, what is life like? What's involved? What are the ups and downs after transition? In my sense, it's making a commitment to live an authentic life, to be true with oneself. But that'll come later, right? So, okay, Abby, I'll go first. This is just the quick newsflash 5 minutes ago, right? So you like to say, when Mashiach comes, it won't be like, get ready, right? Get ready, meditate, take 10 deep breaths, because when you open your eyes, the world will be redeemed. No, it's not going to happen like that. Probably not. Okay. So I was born in 1951. You can do the math. I just celebrated a birthday on Long Island, Patchogue, Long Island. Oh, as one of my rabbis said several years ago, please remember to turn your cell phones on after the talk. It's teaching in the positive rather than the negative, right? So I was born in 1951, upward moving, mobile, middle class family, Patchogue, anyone, I don't know for those. Oh, you've heard of it, wow, okay. So when I grew up, Patchogue was even further out from New York, even though the mileage was the same, but culturally it was in Suffolk County on the South Shore. I grew up by the water all the time. My earliest memory is in the ocean. And I have two sisters, younger than me. Both my parents are Jewish. And everything was wonderful. Everything was wonderful. We were living, my father worked hard outside the home, my mother worked hard inside the home, living the dream of post-World War II, the big putting into the world people that would be known as the baby boomers, and it was a very positive time to be brought up in America. Mother apple pie, homemade chocolate chip cookies, we never had instant mashed potatoes. I mean, it was straight out of a TV show. Everything was perfect, except me. Or so I thought, except me. Of course, I learned later, nobody's perfect. But the contrast in what my outer reality was like compared to my inner reality was as far apart as one could ever imagine. So, and remember, this is 1951, not 2001 or 2019. But I do know as far back as when I was about 5 years old, there was an incident, a little story that happened in my life where I became very aware that I'm a girl. And somehow, my body was not that of a girl. It was as if I were held captive in someone else's body. I had no language for this. I had no language. I didn't know how to even articulate or express my feelings to even my mom. I thought at 5 years old, I was the only person on the planet. Like, I'm sure no one else could be feeling this. This is really way out. This is like a science fiction movie. But it was my life. And I felt that I wanted to be a good child, a good boy in my parents' world, a good girl in my little perfect world. And I just joined the program of just performing and doing what I was told. Actually, my parents said to me later, until I went through high school, even during the worst years, you really were a wonderful child to raise, having no idea the turmoil I was feeling inside. I never felt connected to me. My parents, I don't think a child could ask to have been loved more or felt more respect in the family. It was a perfect, wonderful family. And yet, I felt I had to lie. Every morning when I'd go wake up, I would put on what I put on. And in the 50s, by the way, even in the non-Jewish world, there was a mechitza, all right? And it was called blue over here. Okay, I'll make believe you're at the kotel, right? Men and women, right? Blue over here and pink over there, and the two shall never meet. So growing up that way, the clothes that I wore, the activities that I was forced to by cultural expectations and family expectations, I felt I was you've seen the movie with Barbara Streisand, Yentl? Did anyone see Yentl? She wanted to be in that position. I was forced into that position. And every day was so difficult. Really, really hard for me to be with people that were speaking another language, and there was no immersion olpan that would ever help me become more fluent in it. And I really felt like always a misconnect. And that's how I came into, that's how I grew up. It was very difficult because as a boy, I tended to be more effeminate in my mannerisms. I was teased. You look like a girl, you think like a girl, you talk like a girl, you should be with the girls. I said, but I do, I want to be with the girls. I do. But no one ever said, well, maybe you want to transition? Like they used it as a weapon against me. It was really very, very difficult. But my mom convinced me that I'm special and that you have to put on a smile, go out into the world, and, you know, turn lemons into lemonade. So that's what I tried to do. And then I came. Then I was in college, came to Israel the first time when I was 20, 1971, 20 years later. I came here predominantly to work on a kibbutz. I had learned about the kibbutz way of life in sociology. And even though I come from a Jewish home, we were members of the conservative synagogue. We all went to that dreadful, terrible Hebrew school that we had to go to for 5 years to get ready for a bar and bat mitzvah. And as long as we could read the Hebrew letters in the Haftarah, we got A pluses. And I remember asking the teacher, but what do the words mean? Like, what does it mean? And the teacher would say, you don't have to know what it means, but I want to know what it means. And I will tell you, as far back as then, I felt a connection to the letters. But I didn't know what to do with it because I was told by my parents and by my teachers, I don't have to know. So, okay, then why am I here? Because you have to, because of what you do. So from when I was our bar mitzvah class, and all the girls also at 13, from then to when I came to Israel, I didn't have that much to do with Judaism. I wasn't angry, I wasn't ashamed, it just was like my pinky toe. It was there, but it didn't really define much of my life. I had other things going on, like my spiritual headache, my migraine inside with my gender identity dysphoria, which I didn't even know was a phrase. I didn't even know it was a phrase then. But I didn't even know there was language for what I was suffering from. And I was suffering. So I wanted to work on a kibbutz because I learned about it in sociology class. And I said, I could be in a place where I'm not even supposed to think about me. You know, it's like if you stub your toe or you have a toothache, like that kind of defines your whole day. And, well, I had this chronic anxiety day in and day out. So I said to myself, if I could get a vacation from myself, that'll be a real vacation. So I'll just kind of dive into kibbutz life, and then all my problems will go away, at least for the summer, you know, in between sophomore, junior years in college. So then, while I'm here in Israel, of course, I do what all good tourists do, and interesting tourists, even young backpackers. And I always believed in God, by the way. Always believed in God. God was never the issue for me. What happened, though, when I came to the Kotel, I was not prepared for the turmoil, and then what would happen as a result of the turmoil. I was nothing could have planned, helped me prepare for this. So you know when you're at the plaza, now this is 1971, 4 years after the Six-Day War. It did not look then the way it looks now. I just remember like these, lots of dust with the, what's called the Shikum, with the rebuilding of the Jewish quarter and the whole plaza there. But there was a plaza, and I was looking at the stones coming from a place where if something was 50 years old, that's already considered antique, right? On Long Island in the 50s and 60s. And here I'm being told these stones are part of this wall that's a remnant from the Second Temple. I had no idea what this friend was telling me. What do you mean temple, remnant? I don't even know give me something more. So on one foot, I got basic education of the Roman Empire, conquering the temple, you all know that. And I said, okay, I have to touch those stones. I don't know why. Just to touch something that's 2,000 years old rather than 50 years old, that's already amazing. And then I had to make a decision, like, oh my gosh, wait a minute. I can't go any further without having to decide which locker room to go into. Now, because I didn't come from an Orthodox home, I didn't even know about Mechitza. And we had a lot of family in Brooklyn, the parts of Long Island. Everyone either belonged to a conservative or a reformed temple. So this was all new to me. Another quick lesson, Al Regalachat. Oh, the really religious people have a separate place for men and women, this was before the Ezrat Yisrael, which is only about 4 years old. I know where I would have gone then if there was the Ezrat Yisrael then, but there wasn't. So I had to make a choice. I said, oh my gosh, this is dreadful. I said, I don't know what to do. If I go on the women's side where I know I belong, I'll cause all kinds of problems and attention, which I definitely didn't want. And if I go on the men's side, which I felt the world was commanding me to go by my assigned gender and my body, then I'll betray myself. And here everyone's telling me this is a holy place. This is, you know, God's. Then we had long distance calls and local calls. I know we don't have that today, but this is a. Here it's a local call to God, and this is, you know, really important in Jewish history and Jewish future, hope, belief, redemption. All these terms are floating through. And I said, but wait a minute, how can I lie about me if all this is true? So I almost turned around and left. That's the only way I felt I could have been honest about myself and not raise all kinds of tumult. But I said, I have to touch the stones. I have to. So I bit the bullet once again. I had a lot of training growing up to once again deny me, my identity, my gender identity, which is such a crucial focal point in any culture. Gender defines so much of how we grow up, how we engage with the world, how we go into adulthood, adolescence, adulthood. So I walked to the stones like, oh, I'm really excited to be here, but oh God, if you're really there, you know I'm lying and I'm sorry, but I don't know what else to do. I was like at 20, I was like 80, really feeling so heavy. But I get up to the stones and, you know, it's hot here in June, in the middle of the day, the sun is shining onto the stones. And I put my head up against the stones with this like my spiritual migraine, not physical. And all of a sudden, totally unprepared, and I'm just going to ask you to trust me that this is what happened. I was not on drugs. I was not hallucinating. This is what happened. I felt this voice inside say, it's okay. Welcome home. Welcome home. You're okay. Welcome home. I'm thinking, where did that come from? Home? Long Island's my home. I'm thousands of miles away. What do you mean I'm home? And then I said, say that again. I like the feeling because I wasn't feeling pain. There was a part of me that I didn't know then, but a couple of years later when I started learning text, especially the text of Chassidut and spiritual Torah, that was my first encounter with the divine within me. And it profoundly created a shift because now I had hope. I had hope I could go to a place inside of me that was beyond my own gender identity dysphoria and beyond my misconnect. So I left the Kotel really, really excited. I want to learn Hebrew. I want to learn about modern day political state of Israel, the prophets, the biblical Israel. I wanted it all, the whole Tanakh in 1 month, right? And that started my Jewish journey. In the back of my mind and in my heart, I still didn't know where I belonged in it because I felt now I'm entering into a world where, oh my gosh, gender is even more of an issue. But I really wanted to honor my soul. And that started my Jewish journey. Going into, a few years later, Ultra Haredi, Chabad, Lubavitch, living in Brooklyn. And then I made, check the time, all right. I made this deal with God. You ever hear of the term unilateral agreement? Have you heard the end of that phrase? They never work. You can't decide on behalf of somebody else. But I made this agreement out of desperation on behalf of God and me. God, I'll go to any extreme, because I didn't grow up like looking like Lubavitchers. Just the idea of an untrimmed beard and a black hat or a long dress or covering the hair. I mean, all of it was like, where did this in Brooklyn? I mean, I just knew Flatbush. I didn't know Crown Heights because my family lived in Flatbush. And this was like I walked back in time. But I'm willing to do it. I'm willing to do whatever it takes. But God, I'm just going to ask you for one favor, one little favor. If you split the sea, if you gave them on for 40 years, if you really are who everyone says you are, and I want to learn more about who everyone says you are, then what I'm asking, I don't think it's such a big miracle, even though for me it's my whole life. Could I wake up tomorrow morning, you think, and maybe I feel like I'm a guy? Because then I already have the body taken care of, so you take care of my heart and my soul. Or not knowing about gender transition at all, thinking I'm still the only person dealing with this on the planet, maybe I could wake up tomorrow morning and my body could be that of a woman. Like, that would be amazing. Because I'm already thinking like a woman, and everyone says, talking, throwing a ball, thinking, feeling, doing everything like a woman, so I just need the body to catch up. All I asked for, and I didn't care. I really didn't care. I had no politics. I was not an activist for any cause. I just wanted this, this, and this to all be in the same place at the same time. So then I could be dedicated to my Jewish identity and Torah and God and my people. So as you could imagine, nothing happened except me becoming more and more. Married a woman. We made Aliyah, six children. There were a few goings back and forth in between, but we landed up in the Jewish quarter in 1985. And I was the director of the Chabad house right here at the Tzemach Tzedek Synagogue in the Old City. Maybe some of you have seen it when you go through the Jewish quarter. By the way, there is some importance to it other than what Chabad people believe because it's a Chabad synagogue, so of course they believe it's important. It was the only synagogue not leveled in 1948 by the Jordanians. They decided to leave one standing and they used it as a barn for their mules. So in 1967, it took a lot of work to clean it out, literally clean it out, and then rededicate it. But that's where there was a Chabad house for English-speaking residents, people studying at Hebrew U and Tel Aviv U, tourists. And I was there till 1991, when everything pretty much fell out from under me. I'm going to take a break, because that's my background. Right? After 1991, that's the next section. Does anyone have any questions about my upbringing, what got me to the Jewish quarter by 1985 when I was in my 30s with six children, with the beard and the hat and everything? Could you pass me? I can't move with them. Thank you. I mean, I can, but I'll forget this and then.
Is this on?
Oh, no, okay. It's on, yeah.
You mentioned there was like an initial experience when you were five where you actually felt like you learned what was going on. I was curious what it was.
Okay, so you can either buy my book, you can get it on Amazon, right? Or you can listen to my TED Talk, but I'll tell you the story quickly because I love telling the story anyway, so I was hoping someone would ask. So my parents were getting ready to go out one evening. I don't know where they were going, I was five. And I happened to be in their bedroom, and I was watching my mom get ready. May she rest in peace, Zichrona Livracha. She was beautiful. She was the combination of Jackie Onassis and Audrey Hepburn. That's when she walked, her posture, her elegance, even when my parents didn't have a lot of money, she could wear anything and it was elegant. So I'm watching her, she's applying her makeup, choosing her outfit, her shoes, her jewelry. I'm like, oh my gosh, this is like too good to be true. Like, I want to be just like her when I grow up. Just like her. And all of a sudden she was aware that I was staring at her, and she said, just like she really meant it, more as a directive than a question, well, why don't you go into the bathroom and watch your father while he shaves? Well, you know, he just had to come out of the shower, towel wrapped around, he was doing his thing to go out for the evening. And I'm thinking, like, why? I said, Mom, why? Like, what? And again, I know there are boys who watch their moms, and there are girls who watch their dads, but this is in the 50s. All right, girls watch their moms and boys watch their dads. So I said, why? And then I said to myself, why would I want to watch my father shave? I mean, I love him, but shaving? I could watch my mom apply her makeup and really learn what to do. Like that was that. And then she said, it's like she woke me out of this trance. And she said, because you're a boy. For her, that was the reason. And I said to myself, I'm a boy. And at first, that's when it occurred to me. No, I'm not a boy. But how can my mother and everyone else on the planet be wrong? How is that possible? I am a girl. And every time I went to, each morning when I would run into the bathroom and look in the mirror, I was hoping to see this girl look back at me. So then my mother could say, oh, you were right. Although I never told her I'm a girl. So when she gave me that answer, I said, something's not connecting. Something's not in alignment. There's no, that began.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Men?
You said you had a tough time at school because you knew you were effeminate. Or how was that displayed? How did you display that, in other words? And how did the people know that you were that?
I was just being me. I was just being me. And I was accused of, you walk like a girl, you throw a baseball like a girl. I didn't know what that meant, to walk like a girl or throw a ball like a girl or talk the way I would, I guess, inflect my voice. I mean, whatever I was doing. It's important to mention, though, later on when I did transition, it really turned out to be to my benefit, because I did meet many male-to-female transgender who were undergoing, and they grew up very macho, because this, what we suffer is inside, has nothing to do with our bodies. So there were people like all-star, like type quarterback people, wrestlers, and they had actually a much more difficult transition because they were very masculine. I took what was used against me and it helped my transition, but I'll talk about that in the next section. But it was basically just how I was. And I can still recall certain examples. I no longer feel pain, I just remember them. Yeah. Oh, we sure do. and I don't feel old.
Nobody's learning how to do their makeup from their moms anymore. It's
now they go online.
It's all on YouTube now.
Yeah, you got the.
But my best friend's older sister just had a baby named Adi, and they're raising it gender non-binary. And I just wanted to know, like, they're not even letting the family know, like, what the sex of the baby is. And not letting anybody else change the baby or anything like that. And I was just wondering what your thoughts on like that kind of upbringing until the baby chooses a gender for themselves, if they choose to do so. So I was just wondering.
Well, I want to respect the depth and the seriousness of your question. I can't answer it in the context of this lecture. I mean, that is a separate. And I really do, because it's just so, as we say in Hebrew, mor kavi, it's so complex. And also, that's not my experience. I grew up in a binary gender world, and I live in a binary, my reality is living in a binary gender world. So while I hold, for other people, I hold a very holy place and an honored place for other people, I can't even respond and be authentic. Yeah. Although it's the first I've heard of this. This is another first. Yeah.
Thank you for...
Yeah, I'm going to let Arlene, you do the picking, all right? Thanks.
Thank you for bravely modeling what it looks like to live authentically. I'm curious about that morning that you woke up after making your unilateral agreement with God and finding that he maybe didn't uphold that agreement. So what did that relationship and sense of hope for that relationship look like? And then how did you go on to inspire a relationship like that with other people who you were a teacher or a rabbi for?
Great two questions, wonderful two questions. So I really thought each morning when I woke up that God was messaging to me, I'm not trying hard enough. I never thought God could not do that, what I was asking of God. I so was engaged in this conversation that I just took it upon myself to just be more strict, be more uber this and more machmir that, and just keep pushing the envelope, you know, going more and more to the extreme. So that's what that was my truth. In terms of teaching, I really was drawn to the spiritual aspects of the Torah. Not so much Kabbalah, more the Chassidut from the different rabbis, because when I came into, and I love text, I could live in text. I just love, if you come to my house, you know, if I am not doing anything, I'm learning myself. I just love going into the text. But specifically spiritual texts or books in Tanakh like Tehillim or Shir HaShirim like the Megillot, rather than, I know this is bad to say in the Beit Midrash, and I honor all those tens of thousands of people right now that are learning Gemara, but I didn't connect to it. And I think part of it was, and I was on a very high level Gemara class in the Jewish Quarter for Jewish educators. So I was able to learn. I was able to, like, study it. I won't say learn it. I studied it. And because much of it referred to gender, it was a real problem for me. Where Chassidut talks about the soul, really addressed it. And for me, it was, wow, I could really teach this because this is coming from a deep place. That was my authentic self, teaching the Chassidut. And those who have learned with me know that I teach with passion and commitment, and also with a mastery, or learning to gain a mastery over it, because it really spoke to my soul. Where all the other learnings, the Shulchan Aruch and the Mishnah Torah, all these great holy classics that make up most of a Jewish library, I so respect and honor, and I study very little of it at this time in my life.
Hi, over here.
Okay.
As somebody else from Long Island, I'm from Babylon.
Oh, Babylon. Wow, that's really close to Petra.
Like, when I think Pat Med, I don't necessarily think there's a large Jewish population.
Wait,
even though
Patchogue Medford. I know. Like, I haven't heard that term in so long. Pat Med. Okay.
So my cousins actually live in Pat Med. Yeah. Right off 112. But
I lived off of 112.
They live on First Street afterwards.
Okay.
Anyway, so... As someone else from Long Island, like Babylon, there are not many Jews. 5 minutes any direction, Comac, Five Towns, Dix Hills,
right.
There are. When I think Pat Med, I don't really think Jews. So did you feel like growing up that there were other Jews?
Oh, no.
There
was a significant, actually, in Patchogue itself, where my father was born. May he still live and be well. And he was born, my grandfather was born in Yapank, which is right next to Patchogue. Patchogue had, in that area, a concentrated Jewish population. Much of the businesses on downtown, on Main Street, were mom-and-pop businesses owned by Jewish families. And there was one synagogue, and there was a membership there. I mean, there was a... We very much integrated with the majority of people were Catholic, Italian, German, Protestant, but I never felt ever singled out as Jewish. Actually, my political activism began as a Jew when we were forced to learn all these Christmas carols for the December, right before the Christmas vacation, and a bunch of us Jews in the Hebrew school, we banded together and said, Mrs. Zeiler, I remember her name, she's the music teacher, we want to sing, you know, dreidel, dreidel, dreidel. And she refused. And then we marched to the principal's office, who is Jewish. And he had a long conversation with her. And we sang Dreidel, Dreidel, Dreidel at the Christmas. Yeah. But I never felt like I was the only one, ever. Yeah. One more question. Yeah.
So did you ever think about the fact that had you been able to transition at five, you would have never in the 50s, as someone who was born a little before you, you would never have been able to have the access to Jewish studying that you had as a male at that time?
Oh, wow. I've thought about that a lot. I have no...
So maybe God had a plan?
Oh, I know God had a plan. I never doubted. Actually, a film is coming out about me, produced by Yes Dako and Amifal Pais. It'll be released at the end of December at the Jerusalem Jewish Film Festival, the Cinematheque. And the name of it is I Was Not Born a Mistake, because I wasn't. Oh, I very much believe there was a divine plan in all of this. Yeah. Not my whole life. Some of my life I felt victimized. But then through my transition, which I'll talk about in a few minutes, I moved through a space where if I could do it all over again, and now that I'm 68, I wouldn't change it. I would not have changed anything. Because what I learned, what I know now, I would have never. Actually, I was learning many, many years ago with a group of Chabad women, and one of the women said, there's something about you that's a little bit odd, right? And having transitioned, especially at an older age, I still have retained some of the more, so interesting. And I was so teased for being effeminate, but then after transition, like people would accuse me of like, oh, you must be transgender because you have a masculine look here and a masculine. I wanted that masculine look my whole life. But she said, yeah, I said, you mean I was born transgender and I transitioned. Is this something way I look or like what gave? She said, oh, no, it's just when you're in the class, no woman who's brought up religious can know all of that. I said, if you want me to dumb down to be accepted as one of the gals, I said, you got the wrong girl. No way. I worked hard to get to where I am. I'm not going to dumb down. And really, this was like, I was shocked. Because she was brought up going to women's seminar, girls' schools. And so you're right. I honor my past. I've used it in my present. Yeah. A lot of compassion. Okay, one more question and then I'll move.
So you've spoken about one like you've spoken about the pain of disconnection with parts of self and therefore, you know, as a result, pain, you know, with connecting with other people in the world around you. Karen mentioned, and you talked in response to that access to Hasidut and Jewish learning that you had. You did mention something about, like, at the Kotel, where the spiritual sense, like, kind of soothed, you know, that pain and that hurt. I'm wondering if, in general, like, if you felt Hasidut, like, was more than just being more than being authentic, which is not obviously just, but like, was it also soothing, and was it a source of comfort as you were dealing with the pain?
Always. Always. I think that's one of the reasons, actually, I was really drawn to Hasidut.
How was it?
Because it addressed my soul and being in relationship with God. So it didn't address my external observance, which is very gender-defined at times. It didn't address outer behavior. It addressed inner being present with the divine presence within. And that's genderless. So it was like a salve. Yeah, that was my piece of wholeness, yes. That gave me the fortitude and the commitment to engage in my transition. Right. All right, so I guess we'll move to the next piece. So 1991, during the Gulf War crisis, as the missiles were being fired outside of me towards Israel from Iraq, missiles were really attacking me inside. This was no longer sustainable. I couldn't do this anymore. I couldn't every day go out and make believe and give people the impression that I'm someone that I'm not. I wanted so much to be a good Jew, a good Israeli, a good director of Chabad house, a good father, a good husband, but it was someone else's life. So everything fell out from under me. Basically, I got divorced, broke up. It was a very painful breaking up of the family. I had a lot of status I wasn't looking for the status, but I had a lot of status in the Jewish quarter. I left the Jewish quarter and moved to Tel Aviv. I thought, well, I'll tell my therapist I'm gay. I can't say that, because I was still in 1990 thinking I'm still the only person suffering from this. It's 1990, no longer 19 in the 50s or 1970. This is in the early 1990s. I'm still feeling I'm the only person. We didn't have a TV. Nobody was online yet. No one had private personal computers. So I traded one lie in for another. So I told the therapist we need to get divorced because I'm gay. And yeah, he said that's a good reason. I mean, because you're trying to live a Hasidic life in the Jewish quarter with a family. So I moved to Tel Aviv thinking, because I was a Zionist. I believed I'm home and I wanted to be here. I was here for the Yom Kippur War, the Gulf War crisis. One daughter was born here during another whole big campaign into Lebanon. I really felt committed to being here as a religious, spiritual Zionist. But I felt there was no place for me in Torah. So I took the kippah off, never put it back on. I took the kippah off during the Gulf War crisis. I shaved my beard because the rabbinut in the army said to have the seal be as foolproof as possible, you needed to shave the beard. There was a whole big machlokut with the other rabbis, you can only imagine. But I did shave my beard and I left. As we say in Hebrew, ani chazati l'sheila, instead of ani chazati b'tshuva. And I couldn't do it in Tel Aviv because I couldn't not teach. But I wasn't allowed to. No one wanted me to teach in Jerusalem. So I went back to the States to make more money so I could support my kids. And it was really difficult. And then I started to spiral down this rabbit hole of darkness. I was like ani, we say in Hebrew, nodedet, you know, the wandering Jew. Ayudi nedida, like I was wandering. I didn't know where, like Yosef to'eh b'sadeh. When Yosef was looking for his brothers, not knowing where they went to, he was kind of blundering in the way. And then I started to learn about gender transition. I said, oh my gosh, there's someone else besides me. I can't tell you what that did for me. That was like, if there's one more person besides me on this planet, there's got to be more than just two of us. One of us that I could have lived with and gone crazy, right? But if there's two of us, there's got to be five, maybe 10. I didn't even really care how many more. I just knew there was someone else. And eventually I got online. I started like different support groups within the online community, gathered information, being a person who loves to learn. So I had to learn a lot of information before I engaged in the transition. And then my 50th birthday, 10 years later, I woke up to a very dark day. I was so disconnected. I had no more energy left to breathe air, my air, into someone else's body. That was my spiritual hitting rock bottom. And that's when I said, now's the time. Now my day has arrived. God, no more deals. I'm not gonna make deals. Just please help me live the truth. That's all I ask for. And it's as if God said back to me, oh, you're such a late bloomer. I was waiting for you to just ask me this one question. Of course I'll help you live the truth. But it's my truth, not your truth. Because it's your soul, which is a part of me. And it's like God metaphorically reached out its hand and said, Yiska, hold on. Hold on. Well, I wasn't Yiska yet, but I was becoming Yiska. Hold on and never let go and you'll be fine. And that started my gender transition journey. And that brought me back to Judaism, brought me back to Israel, brought me back to teaching Torah in ways that I never imagined possible. Mamash, never imagined possible. And some of you may be wondering, well, what was the journey like, the actual journey? It was one of the easiest things I have ever engaged in my life. Whatever problems I had did not compare to the problems that led up to that 50th birthday. And I learned patience. I learned compassion. My MO was always running, running, running. Each step along my journey when I was... And here she is, and Abby!
think a lot of people come to Israel to learn a lot of things. I learned never to complain about the subway again.
Okay, so I'm just ending my part two, and
great.
Then you're going to do part
one.
Then you'll do one and two, right?
Great.
So where was I? So happy to see you. Yeah. She's amazing. It's like what she did at, well, you'll see, what she did at her age was not even near in the radar of my life.
I think it was a very different world, but we'll talk
about
that.
We'll talk about that, right. So let me just finish up. What was I going to say? Oh, yeah. My MO was always to run, and burn all my bridges behind me because I was always afraid and lonely and desperation. This time I said, because I really felt God's presence, whenever I'm ready to take the next step, I'll wait a day. I'll wait 2 days. I'll wait 3 days. And you know what? If that's meant to be the next step, it'll be there waiting for me. And that changed internally. Something again shifted within me where all these beautiful midot that we talk about, compassion and love and patience and giving people the benefit of the doubt, that I never was able to cultivate. I was so filled with anger and impatience and shame and guilt. So that moved me through a beautiful transition journey that has humbled me. So when I did get, quote, to the other side, I'm still transitioning, by the way, but it's not a gender transition, it's a soul transition. It's a tikkun. I felt I never knew it would be this good. As I say in the Queen's English, the good is gooder than the bad was better. So I leave you. We're going to just a few questions on that part, and then we'll go to you. All right, if that's okay, in the back.
Would you be able to speak, if not now, then later, about how your parents, your siblings, as well as your children react?
Im lo achshav emetai. What are you doing for the next 4 days?
That's all it takes. Can you just repeat the question so it'll be in my head?
The question is, during my transition journey, could I talk to, we have three generations here, my parents, my siblings, and my children. I'll just say, the short version, there's a complexity to it, which is still changing. My mom, though, may she rest in peace, may her memory be for a blessing. She really got it. I'll just share one quick story with her. And in terms of my siblings and my children, it keeps changing. It's only getting better and better. Actually, I feel now I'm living. I mean, Abby hasn't heard me say this because the last time we shared this story was at Limud, New York, 2.5 years ago. It's radically changed since then. So there's a flow to it because they feel that I'm allowing them to be on their journey. So I didn't come with expectations or demands. But the first time I saw my mom, after my official, I mean, how can you say the transition is over? But, you know, after all the name changed and surgery and all the documents changed, she wanted to see me and see her new son, the new look. She didn't want to see pictures. And of course, we were both very nervous going into this meeting. And I remember hugging her and she was hugging me. We were both crying. And I'll always remember this moment that I want to share with you. She's only passed away 4 years ago, so it's still fresh. But this incident happened many, many years ago. She said, "You don't have to explain anything to me at all. I get it in my heart. Because I see something in you that since you were born, I've never seen before. And that's inner peace. I have known, only a mother could know this about their child. Something was bothering you all the years you were being raised, going into adolescence and adulthood. I knew it, but I didn't know it. I didn't know what it was. So even though in my mind, this is very hard to wrap my brains around, in my heart, I really get it." And then she looked at me in her dignified way. I remember her story from when I was 5 years old. "I don't like the outfit you're wearing. Let's go shopping." And that began until she passed away, well, until a couple of years before she passed away, an amazing relationship, sharing recipes, shopping together. And so she got it. And she said, "Your children will get it, your sisters will get it, but I'm the oldest, and
Can I say something on that? Because the question is probably going to come up again for me in case, if anyone wants. But similar to what you're saying, like, since I was around 12, specifically my father, both of my parents always claimed that there's something wrong and there's something going on and that I'm hiding something. My dad was for a long time convinced that I was gay, which is not necessarily wrong, but that wasn't the point. And then when I came out to them, which we'll get to that later, I told him that you remember you kept on saying you think I'm hiding something, and now I want to tell you. His response wasn't as good as yours, as the one you got. But
well, you didn't hear my father's. You talked about your father's. I'm telling you about my mother. Okay. All right. So maybe one or two more, and then we'll go to Abby about that period of my transition. Any other questions? Okay.
You might get to this during part three, but I'm curious what Yiska means to you and why you chose that.
That happened during my transition. Mm-hmm. I needed to change my name legally. Well, I chose to. That was one of my steps. And I didn't know what to choose. This is a big deal. Look, having helped put six kids into the world, I believed in the tradition that the parents don't really name the child. God names the child because that's the essence. It's revealed to the parents. So then I went to God. I said, I think I'm at the next step in living a true life, a life of truth. So I come to you for my name. And it was as if God said, you'll know your name when I believe I want you to know your name. And I don't know whether it was a month later, 2 months later. I didn't feel any rush. I didn't feel any panic, no desperation. I was driving in a car with a group of friends. And all of a sudden, I know my name. And they were my friends, so they knew I was transitioning. They knew I didn't yet have a female name. And they knew that also I'm coming back into the tradition, so I had to hook it into my Jewish spiritual tradition. They said, okay, whatever, right? I said, I know my name. Guys and girls, my friends, I know my name. And in English, it was Jessica, which is translated from Yiska. Shakespeare actually translated Yiska into Jessica in The Merchant of Venice. That's the first time Jessica was published. So my American passport, I'm Jessica. My Israeli passport, I'm Yiska. And then I learned about Yiska and realized, well, of course I'm Yiska. Oh, of course I'm Yiska. Everything she was before she married Avraham, then she became Sarai. She also went through her name changes. She went from Yiska to Sarai to Sarah. I went from Jeff to Yaakov to Jeff to Jessica to Yiska. So she's like my soul sister, my soul mother. But the depth of looking into the present and seeing what most people don't, that's l'schot, that's very much my life. So yeah. Okay, so Abby, tell us about your upbringing, when you were born, and the part one as we discussed.
So, yeah, I think I'm going to mix.
Yeah, actually, you go part one and two.
Make one out of them. I need to stand a bit. I've been like traveling for 3 hours, and I
from Tel Aviv.
Yeah, I've been trying to get it. It was supposed to take only an hour, but it took a lot more. I want to see a show of hands. Who here had a bar mitzvah? Okay. Who here had a bat mitzvah? Okay, who had both? No one? Okay. Come on, you never got to do one.
Well, I've been called to the Torah as Yiska, so I guess that's a bat mitzvah. Yeah.
I'm saying this because I think it's like overall, it's my life story in very, very brief moment. With a lot of stops in the middle and a lot of steps in the middle. So I was born to a very typical New York family with 12 siblings.
Very typical.
That's not typical? Oh, surprise. Okay. My dad has 10 siblings. My mom has 8. I grew up, I think, not sure if I grew up, but I was raised in a Hasidic community. So let me try something, if I'm allowed to do that. Besides, if you didn't grow up Haredi, ultra-Orthodox, if you did, don't answer that question. And I know that applies to at least one person in the room, maybe a few more. What do you know about Hasidic Jews? Yes.
They believe in being happy and coming from a place of goodness and positivity.
That is very accurate about Hasidism, yeah. I wish it would be more accurate about Hasidic Jews today, specifically where I grew up, but it is a very accurate description. It's one of the, you can say, one of the core beliefs and principles of Hasidic Judaism, definitely. Yes, okay. Specifically, I'm thinking like Hasidic Jews today. Hasidic Judaism and Hasidic Jews have, to put it very briefly, a complicated relationship, I think. Okay, yes.
Very isolated.
Very isolated. That is a very, yeah, one of the most obvious and very descriptive descriptions of the Hasidic community today. Yes. Oh, definitely. Unfortunately, yeah. So she's saying that, like, she had a friend who also grew up Hasidic and felt that it stifled their individuality, which is unfortunately, again, pretty much the antithesis almost to what Hasidic Judaism at least partially started out to be, but today it's very accurate. So to give a few basic descriptions of how I grew up, and I'm not saying not all Hasidic people are the same. So first and foremost, Chabad is a very different ballgame when it comes to the Hasidic culture today, while both claim the name Hasidic. I think everyone has different drinks, and I'm not talking about that at all. And I'm also not saying that there aren't differences. There are differences. They are different families. They're different communities. I'm talking about the way I grew up, but at the same time, it was in no way unique within the Hasidic community. My family didn't belong to some extra radical group within the Hasidic community. So I grew up speaking only Yiddish. Anyone else speaks Yiddish besides you? I don't know who you are, but okay, we'll have to figure that out later. But not just speaking also Yiddish, I spoke only Yiddish. I didn't speak English at all until I was 20 years old, which ends up being a big struggle when you try to find your place in a place like New York. I did speak Hebrew, ironically, a lot better than I spoke English, and I still kind of read Hebrew better than I read English. When I speak Hebrew, I have obviously a very heavy Hasidic accent. We can try that out later if anyone wants to speak Hebrew. Now, I have 5 older sisters, and while having 5 kids, 5 daughters, is probably really common in the Hasidic community, one thing that really bothered my dad, so to speak, was that he was at his 6th child and he only had daughters. And that is a big, unfortunately, it made him sad. And I'm quoting him, he used to say that himself. My mom joked with that when it came to the 4th and 5th kid, my dad would be ashamed to walk into shul and say, hey, I had a daughter. Oh, yeah. Because he started feeling, and then there's also the cultural things, which is going to come into play in a minute when we talk about gender norms within the Hasidic community, which is that specifically for a dad, in any community occasion when they, so to speak, want to show off their kids or bring their kids, daughters are not part of that. You don't take your daughter into a synagogue. You don't take it to a tish. Well, you know what a tish is? Yeah. Amazing, yeah.
They had one with Mike for the other
night. Amazing. Okay. You don't take your daughters, even small ones, with you. So for all intents and purposes, he has been married for 6 years and doesn't have any kids, which might not sound like a big deal, but it isn't a community where everything revolves around family life.
Married 6 years with 5 daughters?
Yeah, so I was born less than 8 years after my parents got married. That is quite the norm. So that was a big part of what I grew up with also. Sorry if I'm going very fast. Slow me down if I do because I'm trying to push in a lot. I grew up very much with the idea that my dad really wanted a boy, and he was so excited for a boy, and I am his oldest boy, and that he needs to have someone who is going to continue his legacy, which in my family specifically means something more. We'll get to that in a second. And I grew up with that since I was really young. I mean, ultimately, I don't feel that bad for him. I do have 4 brothers and then 3 more sisters, but he's fine. He's not going to die without his kaddishal, as they used to say. He has a son. But for me, just for starters, that was already there from the beginning, that not just, oh, you're a boy. You are the, like, long-awaited boy that we wanted so badly. My dad literally wrote me when I, at my bar mitzvah, kind of, he gave me a set of, like, svarim of books, and he wrote in the term B'ni B'chori Yisrael, for those who know, which refers to a lot more than, it literally just means my oldest son in Yisrael was, I don't feel comfortable with that, but that was a name that was attached to me at that point. And it was a big deal. It was very present in my life. Now, in addition to I guess I would say the family, the religious upbringing in the Hasidic community, which in addition to like just speaking Yiddish also includes total shunning of any outside media. And by outside, I mean even like anything that's not Haredi, anything that's not ultra-Orthodox. Like forbidden, I like to say that about music and also about magazines. Like it wasn't that I was aware, I don't know, take any magazine that you want. Forget about porn magazines. We're talking about even like standard magazines, I don't know, Time magazine, wherever it should be. They weren't even on the list of forbidden like things to read. Like in my family, I remember my dad getting really angry after I was married because my ex-wife used to read a Bina magazine. I don't know if you know what that is. It's an ultra-Orthodox magazine, but God forbid it's in English. And so that was kind of, that was the forbidden thing. Like the forbidden music for us was the Miami Boys Choir. For anyone who knows that. Like
not the Grateful Dead?
I don't even know what that is. It was very much I think there's a lot of communities that kind of ban pop culture or say like, oh, this is not good enough. We were so sheltered that we didn't know that that existed. I didn't know that, I don't know, what was the most Jewish show in the 90s? Seinfeld or whatever? It wasn't even, oh, we can't watch that show. If you would have told me even 10 years ago about any of these shows, any of the big shows of the 90s, I would have no idea what you're talking about. And the same happens when it comes to gender and sexuality. When I started my transition, specifically my work in activism within the Hasidic community, mostly working with people from the community, also struggling people who want to leave and so on, I used to joke that the day the Hasidic community becomes homophobic and transphobic, I've accomplished the first part of my goal.
Oh.
And it sounds weird, but in all reality, yeah. Growing up, I sometimes wish that I had a teacher when I was 12 years old who made transphobic comments. Because, I mean, I wish they wouldn't be transphobic and would just be accepting, but that wouldn't have happened regardless. But if they would have at least been against it, I would have known that it exists. Like, I only knew that there's a life out there. Like, obviously, I knew there are people who are outside of our community. But I only knew that that's a possibility, leaving the community, because I had a cousin who was a criminal and mentally ill and a drug addict. And, like, he wasn't. But that's what we were told about him because he loved the community. So I knew that that's a possibility because of all the negatives about it. I sometimes wish that there would be a negative, that at least at that point I would have spoken about trans people negatively, because at least I would have known that it existed. It didn't. And I didn't know that trans people exist until I was 20 years old.
It's incredible how we
exist. At the same time, I very much knew who I was. I'm not going to get too graphic. When I was 4 years old, I tried to do something very physical. Mm-hmm. And I was a four-year-old child that I don't even know how I knew that, to be exactly accurate, that for about 98% of the population, there are specific differences in their private parts between boys and girls. I don't know if I knew it. It was something that I felt. It was something that I was ready to do something physical about it. But I didn't know that it exists out there. The Hasidic community, as far as I know, is the most gender-segregated society, at least in North America. I'm yet to interact with any community. And again, when I'm talking Hasidic, I'm talking where I grew up, Williamsburg. If you know Israel better, Williamsburg is literally the equivalency of Mea Shearim, other than the fact that they prefer to throw eggs instead of rocks when they disagree with you. But for those who get the reference. But at least where I grew up, gender is, as much as they don't talk about it in the sense of gender identity, it's extremely prevalent. Your position in society, everything, not just what you dress and where you are, but what is your position at home, what kind of education you get, who you're allowed to socialize with, everything is determined by gender. And since a really young age, to some extent that was a struggle because I felt like I'm on the wrong side of Mechitza, literally and figuratively, but also at the same time it was very clear to me which side and which part I belonged to. Now, throughout my life, growing up, I had different periods of finding ways to deal with it. I thankfully have a very creative imagination, which I think is the only reason I stayed sane for a long time, which was trying to figure out ways of what I'm going to do. So, for example, when I was 6 years old, and it was right after I learned how to read, at that point it was Yiddish, without vowels, like, you know, Hebrew vowels, nukudot, And young kids usually learn to read Hebrew or Yiddish with the vowels, and finally I learned without it. So I was able to start reading newspapers. Don't worry, not the New York Times. So like local Hasidic Yiddish newspapers that are being published every week. And for a while, every time, that's when I learned the first time about like organ transplants. And I think anyone who's heard me talk might have heard that story before, but for a while, I was collecting newspaper clippings, or there was a magazine published by Hamaspik, which is like a mental health institution, and they have a health magazine published every year, a health newspaper kind of published every month. And I would collect like all newspaper clippings, and in my head, I was going to do a full body transplant at some point, which obviously is medically incoherent, but I didn't know anything. And then when I was 9 years old, and that is something that's very important, I want to try to focus a bit on that part, and it's going to come up later also. And I remember thinking to myself, get over it, like that's not going to happen. So I decided to turn to the one kind of like figure, so to speak, or being in my life that I was always told that they can do anything. So I wrote a prayer that I still have until today, and I translated it into my book that's coming out in November. You can all read it. I wrote a prayer that I would say every night. We said the Shema, the bedtime prayers. And I would add this prayer that I want to wake up as a girl. And a big part of it was like going, kind of like making my arguments with God. Like a lot of Hasidic stories, I think, go of Hasidic rabbis kind of arguing with God back and forward. Or like Avram in the Torah. And I was like, hey, listen, like you can do anything, right? So how about we make a deal here? I am going to wake up as a girl, and then I will be the most religious...
This is why we talk together.
I will be the most religious woman there is. And ironically, when I'm reading it now, I'm buying into all stereotypes of what it means to be a woman. But that is what I knew at the time. I'm going to be a good housewife. I'm going to have as many kids possible. Part of my argument sometimes was, if you want, give me only boys. If you need to make up for the loss, like I was really trying to find my place and trying to figure out how to happen. And now you can look at it either way. You can either look at it and be like God answered a prayer or decide not to. That is up, I think, to anyone's opinion on what that meant.
What year was this, by the way?
Huh?
When you were nine?
This was in 2000.
2000, and I'm in the 50s. It's like word for word, almost.
Yeah. So this was, anyway. And then that lasted until I was around 12. And then kind of was my first breaking point with God. And I wouldn't even say I became angry. To me, it was very much my train of thought was, you're all telling me, the same people are telling me that I'm a boy, which interestingly, and I think thankfully, because I think unfortunately a lot of LGBTQ people growing up in communities like these or anywhere in the world are slowly sometimes being subconsciously pushed into doubting their own identity. And I never had that. But to me, it was... The same people who are telling me that I'm a boy are also telling me about God and about Judaism and about religion. If they can be so wrong about who I am, why would I trust them for anything else? And that started down a path of first reading forbidden books, which is really easy in the Hasidic community because pretty much everything is forbidden. Like, including when I was in eighth grade and my teacher caught me studying Sefer Yoshua, Books of the Prophets, just Book of Joshua, in depth. And while obviously, like Nevi'im, like the prophets, they're holy, we're almost consciously encouraged not to study them in depth. Like, yes, you can look at it for references, but don't study it in depth. And I think for anyone who has studied, there are stories there that are a bit sometimes hard to swallow, specifically if you grow up in a place where everything is black and white.
Literally.
And he was like really, he was getting upset at me, and he was like, it's not meant for young kids to study that in depth. And he was partially right, because that kind of did jumpstart for me the ball started rolling. And I'm not going to share all the details again. I talk a bit more detail about it in the book, where I ran into a commentary from the Ralbach, Gershenides, that led me to read the first book of philosophy when I was 13, called Melchamot Hashem, Words of God, a philosophy book from... the Ralbag. Any of you know who the Ralbag is? If not, look it up. The Ralbag was considered one of the Rishonim, but when it comes to Emunah, when it comes to beliefs, he had a very, very different approach. He disagreed with at least half of the 13 principles of faith of Maimonides. He had a very different approach. Very long story short, when I was 15, I was already past reading a lot of books, including from the outside, mostly in Hebrew. I couldn't read in English. And I was going to drop everything. And then I met a rabbi from here, from Yerushalayim, actually, when he visited New York, who was a Kabbalist. And a Hasidic, kind of a Hasidic, it's called a mashpia, a Hasidic teacher who's not necessarily a Rebbe, but someone who is focusing a lot on kind of the essence of Hasidic Judaism. Kind of very similar to what you said originally, like that is his idea of Hasidism. And the reason I was drawn to him was because his first book was an all-out attack against the Hasidic culture of today. And he was all about, like, today they're making it all about which kind of, like, how big your hat is and which kind of shtreimel and bekicha and how long your coat is and which kind of socks you wear, instead of about what Hasidic Judaism was really supposed to be. Thanks to him, because of him, good or bad, is still up to interpretation, ended up staying religious for another 5 years, during which time I decided that I want to get smicha. I want to get ordained. I want to get a rabbinical degree, which is not everyone. Contrary to popular belief, not every Hasidic person is a rabbi. And I would say for my class of 100 students from the yeshiva that I went to, there was only 10 that were even attempting to get smicha. And by the time I left, there was only one other person who did. And I was like, I'm going to get into that. And it was two reasons. Part of me really wanted to know everything. And I think a bigger part of me was, if I'm going to rebel, I need to know what I'm rebelling against. I want to know this in depth. During that time, I got married. I had a son when I was 19. Oh, yeah, sorry. Forgot to mention that. I got engaged when I was 16. I was engaged for a year and a half. Got married when I was 18. 16, okay, is relatively considered young, but 17, 18 is fairly normal in the Hasidic community. If you're 20, you are old, for boys and girls. I know in other Haredi communities, boys tend to get married sometimes a bit older, but in the Hasidic community, it's equality, you know? 18 for boys and girls. And around the time my son was born was when I think I was, for a while, I was on a high. I was high from Kabbalah. I was on a high on mysticism, which is real. Like, I used to sit I went to a yeshiva in the Catskill Mountains of New York, for anyone who knows, the former Borscht Belt. And, sorry, I'm afraid you're dating yourself by laughing, but that is okay. Anyway, I went to school and I would sit in on the fields and the grass and like observe grass as they were shaking, and like I could have sworn that I saw the angel that the Talmud says is dedicated to every piece of grass.
You did then, maybe.
However, yeah, I think I'm gonna leave the interpretation. I'm gonna leave up to everyone and to ourselves, and we can get to that more when we get to questions. At that time, like, as my son was being born, I think the reality of bringing in another person into the world overshadowed. Like, there's only so much that you can be on a high. You can, like, there's only so much that drugs can do, you know? There's only so much that Kabbalah could do in keeping you in check. And for me, it was really hard. Any parents in the room?
Oh.
Okay. How many of you ever had the feeling that you were going to fail as a parent and you were going to be the worst parent ever? Great. Amazing. Pretty much everyone. And I think it was a lot harsher for me, like getting the feeling of I'm living a lie, that I was convinced. I don't even know who I am and how I am. How could I raise a child? How could I have a child? Maybe it's genetic. That was a big fear for me. That maybe, I don't know, whatever I'm feeling, which I didn't know anything about, what if my son is going through the same things? What if my child, like, how am I going to deal with that? That was, for me, the punchline. That was kind of, in throughout my life, and sometimes even today, I'm trying to think back and figure out which part was the gender part, which part was the religious part. Because when I left the Hasidic community, it wasn't just because of gender. Knowing everything I know today, even if I wasn't trans, or even if the Hasidic community fully accept me, I have no interest in going back. So I didn't leave just because of my identity, but it's hard for me, and I think you would have that feeling. It's almost impossible to separate, I think, a spiritual and religious journey from an identity. Because, as I would say, as we'll get to in a minute, I guess that's part of part three, as I have learned lately, the transition could be the most spiritual journey ever.
Legamri.
And it definitely has been for me, and I think that is part three, right? Yeah. We're going to talk about that. So just chronologically, very quickly, I came out to my ex-wife, not gender-wise, just as being not religious, and it's very interesting because in our community, some people call it off the derech, yotzim b'sheila, ex-Orthodox, formerly religious, formerly Orthodox, whatever you want to call it, the experience is to some extent very similar to the experience of a lot of LGBTQ people of coming out, and we use the same lingo sometimes. People are still in the closet, people living double lives, and so on. So I first told her about my religious beliefs, and we had amazing conversations. She was kind of on board until her family stepped in. Once I got divorced, I was pretty much done with the Hasidic community. First, I had to work on my education. As I said, I didn't speak English. The only math education I had was long division. That was like in eighth grade. We studied that, and that's it. The Hasidic community, like at least for those being raised as boys, they don't even attempt to teach science, social studies, history, like nothing, not even a bit. So I had to catch up on all of that. I had to get my, at that point, it was the GED, the high school equivalency diploma. Started applying to colleges. And throughout this time, and I know, like, from talking with you, like, I know you also had this, like, throughout your story, I was constantly hoping that something is going to happen, and everything I feel about gender is going to go away. Kind of a similar thing to praying the gay away. I was just, like, hoping the gender away, whatever you want to call that, hoping that at some point I'm just going to be comfortable with myself. And it was like, if I'm going to leave the community, if I'm going to get my high school diploma, if I'm going to get into a good school, all of that was, like, constant steps that I have to do that is going to just make it go away. And finally, I think my first semester in college, which was in the fall of 2014, was my final kind of realizing that I'm never going to be happy. I'm never going to be able to live a normal life if I don't transition. It took me still another year, but I started kind of, let's say, the physical transition in September of 2015. Then I came out quite publicly, and then it became a lot more public to no fault of my own. In November of 2015, my bat mitzvah, which you can all watch online, it's called the Celebration of Life in Transition, one of the most beautiful ceremonies that I have witnessed. And for me, to be honest, I'm not, I think that's a part where we are quite different. I don't identify necessarily as religious. My Judaism, I say, is cultural and spiritual, but then you got to start asking what really is religious and who decides what it means to be religious and what it means to be spiritual. But to me, it was a very important moment, and we can talk a bit more about that in the part three. And I'm here now. I have a book coming out, which I think is the next big milestone in my life. It's called Becoming Eve. Already available on Amazon. Coming out November. For any of you in New York, November 13, 92nd Street Y, it's going to be the book launch event. So you're all welcome to attend. And yeah, I would love, we'll talk more, I guess, about the spiritual present.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, should we do questions? So,
yeah.
Any questions? Wow. Okay. Go ahead. Yeah.
Once you left your marriage, where did you live and how were you able to support yourself and did you receive any support?
So, right, the good thing and I think the privileged thing that I have had, to be honest, with both kind of transitions, though I like to look at it as one big transition, but with both was that, which didn't exist even 10 years ago, were the support networks. There's an organization in New York called Footsteps that for me has been life-saving. It's an organization that is helping people leaving the ultra-Orthodox community. Same thing happened when I kind of transitioned. There's a lot of amazing support groups. But I joined Footsteps in the spring of 2012, which was almost a year before I actually physically left the community. So by the time I did leave, I had some support network. My parents at the time, to quote my dad, he said, when my child has cancer, I wouldn't disown them. So I think you're sick, but I'm not going to disown you for that. So my parents still spoke to me. I ended up living with my parents for a while until I started college. And then I moved out. And the first place that I lived outside of the community was actually, ironically or not ironically, a Jewish co-op at Columbia called the Bayit. Anyone here knows anything about the Bayit? That was kind of, I think, a really good kind of transition phase. And I've been living in that area ever since. But yeah, definitely, I wouldn't have survived without the support of organizations. Go ahead.
Then we should do part three because we only have 15 minutes left.
How did you learn English? How long did that take? What was that like? I think I'm still learning. But it was definitely, I think, one of the biggest struggles. And partially, the reason why the Hasidic community speaks only Yiddish, it's kind of a new thing. Throughout history, that didn't exist. Jews throughout history, maybe the first, second generation didn't speak the local language. But something that you have now, where you have people living in New York for four or five generations and not to speak English, is a new idea in Jewish life in the diaspora. Throughout Europe, by the time you got to three or four generations, everyone spoke the local language. Like, my grandparents' generation all speak Polish and Hungarian and Russian, but God forbid we speak English. If they were allowed to speak their language. Like, my grandparents would speak in Polish all the time, but if we spoke English, we got in trouble. And so that has been a big struggle. I started by watching TV shows. I think
you watch
three
TV?
When I started out, the three biggest ones I think that really helped my language, and for a while it kind of sucked because my idea of popular culture, my idea of the culture outside was based on How I Met Your Mother, Friends, and Gilmore Girls. So like, it wasn't that realistic, but that really helped. So to be honest, the first TV shows that I watched still were in Hebrew, but then I moved on to English. I took some classes. I took ESL classes. I didn't feel really comfortable with my English until I started school, until I started university at Columbia. And even the first year was still a bit, But it's, ultimately, I don't even know. I sometimes wonder, because I know people have lived in the U.S. for longer than I did, culturally. And I don't know. I have honestly no idea how my English is so good, to be honest. But yeah.
So Arlene has reminded us that we don't have that much more time, so we'd like to just go right into part three. I'll summarize where I'm at presently, and then you will. And if we have time for questions, well, yeah. So where I am today is very much a... By the way, thank you so much. That was like... Each time I speak with you, I'm so amazed, right?
I heard being too fast, but yeah, I'm just trying.
Yeah. Well, because you and I never have enough time together, right? Okay. So where I am today is very much informed by particular rebbes in particular, the PSS and the Rebbe, and also there's a teaching from Rav Kook that very profoundly really has I hold very dearly. And he writes in Shemona Kavatzim that every person's soul needs to do three things. He says, L'hit rachev, l'hit lahavot, and l'hit gaver. Each person's soul needs to expand, needs to be enlivened with passion, and needs to become strong. And in order to do that, he teaches two things have to happen. Certain obstacles in life, michsholim, have to be taken away, and then certain other parts have to happen that nurture the soul. And I feel very much like my transition journey, what was so holy and spiritual and amazing and miraculous about it, it allowed me to take the obstacles away. So what I've been doing since that part of my life came to an end and I re-entered the next chapter in my soul transition is I have become dedicated to nurturing my soul. Nurturing my soul like a plant with the right amount of water, the right amount of sun, the right amount of nutrients. And where I am today, in light of, actually, Abby made a remark about me being religious.
I said you would understand it better.
Yeah. So I no longer consider myself to be as religious as I used to. I'm more spiritual. And about 3 years ago, when someone from the J Post interviewed me right before Rosh Hashanah and asked me about how I feel about being an Orthodox woman in Jerusalem after having transitioned, I said, wait a minute, there's something that doesn't feel right about that question. I'm not Orthodox. And I realized that's my gift for Rosh Hashanah. That part of my authentic living and part of, like Rav Kook says, to really be faithful, the eman, to my atzmiuti, mamash, is I no longer see most of me in the Orthodox movement, nor any movement, actually. I feel I'm post-denominational, and I'm more spiritually enlivened, spiritually committed. I see a pieces of me in all the different movements, and the bigger part of me in none of the movements. I have a high regard for my halachic observance, and I go to different rabbis for different pieces of information about halacha, and then I go to spiritual mentor for my spiritual guidance in my life. And then just to, so for those who know me, I'm a teacher here. It's such a privilege to be able to teach spiritual Torah here. I have a private mentoring practice. I work with all kinds of individuals, helping them along with guidance, Hadrucha Ruchanit, along their spiritual journeys. I travel all over the world. I just returned from the Berkshires. I'll be in New York and in Durham, North Carolina, after the Chagim. I'll be at Limud representing Pardes in December. I go all over the world. Yeah, you're going to be?
Yeah.
All right, we'll do another panel together. This time we're going to ask him for 3 hours, all right?
Yeah.
we will, all right? And basically, you know, reconnecting with some of my children, my gardening, my cooking, living in Nachlaot with Arlene. I'm so lucky to have, blessed to have her as my neighbor. And doing my swimming and living a life, living my full life, I sometimes forget I even transitioned. I really do. Because this is even more than what I ever dreamt for. More. And I am more able now to go all over the world, walk into a room where I don't know anyone, as I just did in the Berkshires, except for the rabbi who invited me, who I met here, and one woman who remembers me from years ago from Patchogue. It's amazing, right? She knows my parents. Except for those two people, I walked into a room, I was able to connect with everybody. With everybody, because I'm coming from a place of truth, of really my own sense of how God wants me to be, as we say in Shabbat, V'tahel libeinu l'avdecha be'emet. May you purify our hearts so we can work with you, be with you, serve you in truth. And now I'll give it over to you.
I want to read something. In our tradition, leaving Egypt wasn't an historical event alone. In our tradition, it was a personal and existential leaving as well. And every generation, a person must regard themselves as though they personally had gone out of Egypt. Whenever we leave a narrow place, a place of constriction, painful servitude, a place where we are not authentically who we are, that leap-taking, that transitioning is an exodus, a freedom walk. So that is something that I read out a lot, and it's the intention that Rabbi David Ingber, for those who might know him from Romamu, set as I was going to walk up to the Torah to get my new name and during my bat mitzvah / naming / celebration ceremony. Where I am today in life and with Judaism in a big way has been the message that tolerance is not enough. Actually, I hate tolerance.
Me too.
Whenever I actually don't tolerate LGBTQ people. Like, tolerance I always feel is like for lactose, you know, you can be lactose tolerant or lactose intolerant, and that is fine. People, we gotta celebrate. And I think that Judaism has given me tools to allow me to do that. Where I am in my personal religious life is a very different ballgame, and I am a member at the same time of several groups, like for example on Facebook that are for rabbis, women rabbis, and queer rabbis, and trans rabbis, and just progressive rabbis as a whole. And at the same time, I'm a member of several groups that are for atheists and questioning and so on. And I don't just nothing. It's not just that they're not a contradiction. To me, they go together beautifully. And I have been doing this work a lot. I've given over 300 speeches in the last 3 years, literally in, I think, every continent. Yeah, on every continent. I have spoken, yep. Not Antarctica, but sorry, sick. That good catch, yeah. Besides Antarctica.
Let's go there together.
Yeah, we'll do that. We'll make that happen. But for now, and it has been a big part of my journey. And I think for me, what has been so pushing me forward is that every single time, literally every single time, there's been at least one person in the audience that had a personal story to tell, whatever it was themselves, their family, their kids, their neighbors, their anyone. And that is extremely powerful. I did school at Columbia where I studied gender studies and political science. I also started doing a master's, not going to go into that right now. I have a book coming out, which is, again, going to take me around the globe. You are all invited wherever you live. There's definitely going to be an event there, and I would love to see you all. On my day-to-day life, my day job, so to speak, I actually work in public policy. I just started working with a friend of mine who's running for Congress. So if you live in the New York 13th District, registered voter, make sure to come talk to me. And this is where I am. Wow. And also one quick thing, totally shameless plug. For any of you who don't know what Safari is, you probably shouldn't be allowed to be a part of but Safari is the biggest online database of Jewish texts. It's a beautiful thing, safari.org. Check it out. You can look up my name. I have 41 different source sheets on there looking on gender and Judaism, sexuality,
remarkable,
and so on.
Remarkable. So maybe one question for the both of us. How's that?
Yeah, that would be great.
Yeah. Okay, I'll let Arlene decide.
Abby, have you been able to maintain a relationship with your son?
Oh. Quickly, I don't mind answering most questions. I don't want to talk about my son. Yeah. Yeah. Let's see if I get one that goes for both ways.
Yeah. I wonder, what does Israel, what the role of Israel and Israel's society in your, where you are, and how it helped you, didn't help you, how did it affect you?
You go.
Oh, okay. Huh. So I think we're both dual citizens, right? I'm also an Israeli citizen, just by birth. I have a complicated relationship with Israel. I think the easiest way for me to describe is, and I always tell people, is that I would have loved to love Israel. I really feel sometimes that I wish I would feel more like I love this place, like emotionally and compassionately and culturally. And my family, my grandma's family, has lived there for hundreds of years in Yerushalayim, and before that in Tzfat and in Tveria. I have a very strong connection, but then a lot of things that are going on, I feel really uncomfortable with, just like in the U.S., to be honest. I think a lot of the things that I've been doing that some people take as negative actually for me comes from a place of caring and deeply caring. People ask me sometimes, oh, why do you say something negative about Israel, not about, I don't know, some other country? I'm like, because I don't care about that other country that much, and I do care about what's happening in Israel because it matters to me and it's personal to me. I think I would love to see more people, specifically in Israel, I think focused on the domestic issues as well. Forget about the international issues are yeah, it's a pod that is hard to, like, anything that you say, everyone is going to get assaulted. It's, like, not just one side. It's, like, everyone is going to get assaulted on everything. But also, I think there's a lot of, I was just hanging out yesterday with a family of mine that I didn't really know exists. It's a long story on its own that I found a few months ago, literally, like, a second cousin. And I was hanging out, we're having dinner on the beach in Tel Aviv. And they were talking about, and they're all, like, relatively, like, I don't want to say even left-wing, but really progressive. And they were feeling, and I was ironically the one who was coming from the outside and being the most optimistic. I'm like, no, I think we can do better. And I think that there could be progress, and I think there could be less of a control from an ultra-Orthodox rabbinical court to decide everything. And they were the ones who kind of felt like giving up, which is very similar, I think, the mentality that I felt in the U.S. after 2016 election, that I think has a bit changed after the last election. I would love to see, I don't know, I always feel like this, feel like, what is my place, specifically in domestic issues, being that, yes, I'm a citizen, I have family here, but I don't live here. Am I, like, really want to come in and tell people what to do? Yeah. Does that, like, not answer, but answer the question?
No,
yeah, okay. Yeah.
And I'll conclude with my answer to that. I'll make it really fast. In 1971, as you heard when I came here for the first time, I met my husband for life. My lover for life. We've been in a relationship now. Our marriage has been from 1971 through now. We've had ups, we've had downs, but this is always my home. And my allegiance as a person is always first and foremost to Israel and the security of Israel, notwithstanding that that's not always simple. I've raised children here. They've gone into the army. I hope my grandchildren don't have to go into an army, but if they do, it'll be the Israeli army. And this is my home. And I'll leave it at that. Yeah.
I think we have time for one more.
Were either of you able to maintain friendships or connections, not familial connections, like friendships or romantic or past romantic connections before and then until after the transition? And then, like, what do you think it is that kept those relationships to be able to be maintained as opposed to ones that might have fallen away?
I have been able to maintain some, not all. either it was a choice by the other person or by me or by both of us. But yet, with some who were in my prior life, we have continued with several of them. Yes.
I think I would have to differentiate between before leaving, because I left the community 7 years ago. I transitioned like almost 4 years ago. So pretty much almost all of my friends, literally, that I made in the last 7 years, even before transition, I've not just stayed around, but been amazing friends and a chosen family even to a big extent. From before, there are not many. There's a few friends that I grew up with, mostly people have also left, that I am in touch with. There's a very small, but I think surprisingly strong, kind of contingent of Hasidic Jews that have been, not necessarily people that I knew before, but that have been supportive, usually not that publicly, but at least privately. And I'm not stupid, it's a tiny minority of the Hasidic community, but to me that it means a lot because of having grown up and because I constantly I like to be naive and dream that in 50 years from now, we'll be able, for someone who wants that, I personally don't want that, but for someone who wants to be part of the Hasidic community and be openly trans, I want to be naive and think that's possible, and there's a small group of people that make me think that at least with them,
be naive, have dreams, because great. Your very life is what I dreamt for when I was your age. Exactly. Okay? So you are living my dream. Don't stop dreaming.
I know. Yeah.
Thank you all.
Thank you. Thank you, Jessica and Abby.
Thank you for downloading this podcast from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. To download digital content, please visit elmod.pardes.org.